Hello and welcome to a brand new episode of Nerds Talk Movies. My name is Taylor Cole. I'm going to be your host today. Joining me, as always, are my two wonderful co-hosts, Drew Garrison and Tristan Benz. Tristan, let's start with you this week. Tristan, how you doing?
You know, I'm feeling amazing, feeling sensational. I'm feeling like a member of the friendly neighborhood, you know. Don't know if I'm doing spectacular, though. I think Drew's going to be the spectacular one today. But, you know, I'm doing all the other Spider-Man adjectives. That's how I'm feeling this fine Tuesday afternoon when we're recording.
Are you feeling a little ultimate as well?
You know, I feel like I reached on I do feel a little ultimate. I do feel like, I'm trying to think, what's another? Drew, give me another Spider-Man adjective. Well, I'm feeling a little web of.
Web of, spectacular, ultimate.
A little nonstop, a little savage, little avenging. You know, feeling like doing a little avenging. I'm feeling a little and the X-Men. Yeah, so that's how
a little
I'm doing.
And the X-Men.
Yeah, you never read Spider-Man and the X-Men? That's the one where the panel of him talking to the dinosaur guy comes from, that everyone turns into a meme, where it's like, I don't want to cure cancer. I want to turn people into dinosaurs.
But you are not the only person on this podcast. We heard his wonderful voice before. We're also joined by Drew Garrison. Drew, how you doing?
Well, I'm living on the edge, fighting crime, spinning webs, swinging from the highest ledge, and leaping above our heads.
Well, there you go.
There he is. Well, we're going to get into this show here in a quick second, but that theme song, I don't think it's the best theme song for Spider-Man.
Whoa.
I think the 90s one's the best. That said, this spectacular Spider-Man theme, it gets stuck in your head.
It's incredibly.
It's one of the most catchy songs I've heard from an animated series. But you clicked on this podcast. You saw the title. Today we are taking a look at Spectacular Spider-Man Season 1. Personally, I don't really know anything about this series going in, other than a lot of people adore this adaptation of the Webhead. Oh, and I know that this show was ultimately canceled due to some drama between Sony and Disney. I actually think the drama happened right after Disney bought Marvel.
Yep.
So, I'm going to turn this over to the guy who put Spectacular Spider-Man on our sacred wheel for this month. Drew, do you have any cool bits of trivia to add or any background info that we'd like to know about?
Oh, do I ever. So first off...
Well, do you or don't you?
Okay. So, first off, Spectacular Spider-Man, it was created by Victor Cook, and apparently he has admitted that he had a bit of help when getting this, when writing this up for the first time. Now, it's stated that he got a little bit of help from Dwayne McDuffie, not directly, but apparently, in Cook's mind, thanks to Dwayne McDuffie's help, he believed that this could be the Justice League series for Spider-Man. Like, this could have spawned off into a whole thing where it could have had different TV shows in a confined universe where Spider-Man was the start and everything else would come from it. Like, apparently they were going to introduce mutants, they were going to introduce the Avengers, all stemming from Spectacular Spider-Man. And from the way that things were going, and how popular this thing was when it first came out, it could have happened. It really could.
Should have happened, some might say.
Yeah, it should have happened. But unfortunately, yes, behind-the-scenes drama got this thing X-nayed, and eventually it was replaced with Ultimate Spider-Man, where Drake Bell was the voice of Spider-Man, and it was to fit more in line with the MCU and, you know, Avengers Assemble and all those stuff that spun out from it.
See, it's funny you say that because I got it mixed up because I've had people recommend Spectacular Spider-Man to me before. I got it mixed up with Ultimate Spider-Man.
Ew.
Oh, okay.
So when I watched Ultimate Spider-Man and people, I was like, what? Because I didn't like the series. All right, I just didn't care for it. And I knew that they were going to throw Miles in there and Venom and all these cool characters. I'm like, all right, maybe it gets better later. But I just couldn't get through it. It just wasn't great. So it's kind of funny you mentioned Ultimate Spider-Man spawning from this.
Yeah, because it was sort of taking on what Cook wanted for Spectacular Spider-Man. And unfortunately, like Ultimate Spider-Man, I'm not gonna say Ultimate Spider-Man is like terrible. It's just not that great.
See, okay, so we're reviewing this here, and I'm using reviewing pretty loosely. A show that, while we enjoy it as adults, it is also still meant for kids. That said, I'm kind of surprised how much this show didn't really feel as kiddish as I thought it could, but Ultimate Spider-Man definitely did. I think that's the big difference.
No boy did it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the thing, too, that like I more compare this to the 90s series, too. So I think these two, both 90s series and Spectacular Spider-Man, I think had that feeling of, like, you can still enjoy it 15 years later, to whereas Ultimate Spider-Man, I don't think it's gonna, you look back on it and try to rewatch it, you're just like, yeah, oh, well, maybe my kids or my nephews or nieces would like it.
Yeah, this one is more of a Spider-Man. Spectacular Spider-Man is more of a Spider-Man for all ages. And it is definitely for those fans of Spider-Man. And it even tried, like, it was even, like, setting up to go into a lot of storylines that are not just the good ones, but also the infamous ones. Like, for when we go into season two, just to FYI, Miles Warren is in there. For anyone who doesn't know who Miles Warren is... He is the Jackal, and he was the start of the Clone Saga, one of the most infamous Spider-Man sagas that people hate to death about.
They will now, go Taylor, to- Taylor, you may ask, when it comes to the Jackal, what's his whole thing? Well, he dresses up in a furry green suit, and then he likes to clone people.
Including himself. And especially... Especially Gwen Stacy.
Oh boy, does he love cloning Gwen Stacy? Oh boy, does he? And Peter Parker. Those are his two bugaboos. Like, if I had a dollar for every time he'd cloned them, I tell you what, I'd be 3 years ahead on rent.
Well, let's go ahead and get into this here, though. So here's some of the voice cast and the crew for Spectacular Spider-Man Season 1, courtesy of this small known website known as IMDb.
Never heard of it.
The series was directed by quite a few people, including, as Drew mentioned before, Victor Cook, Jennifer Coyle, Dave Bullock, Kevin Altieri, Michael Guggen, Troy Adomatis, I'm really sorry if I mispronounced that one, Dan Fawcett. And here is some of the star-studded voice cast. I just kept adding names here because...
It's a great cast.
It is a spectacular cast. Some might even say amazing.
We're going to use a lot of puns. So if you don't like puns, I do apologize ahead of time. This is going to be a pun film.
If you don't like puns, you don't like Spider-Man. Spider-Man is the pun king.
That is true. That is very true. So we had Josh Keaton as Peter Parker / Spider-Man. We had Kevin Michael Richardson as Tombstone. It took me a few seconds to realize that was Kevin Michael Richardson.
I noticed it
once
right
I did.
Away.
I was just like, "Oh, that's a legendary voice actor right there. Perfect." We had Lacey Chabert as Gwen Stacy, James Arnold Taylor as Harry Osborn, Steve Bloom as Green Goblin. Does he also voice Norman Osborn?
No, that's Alan Ratchins, I believe, who voices Norman Osborn. Has two different voice actors.
Okay, I couldn't find the voice actor for Norman Osborn, so thank you for that. Peter McNichol as Doc Ock, Clancy Brown as Rhino, the legendary Clancy Brown, Jeff Bennett as Shocker, Bender himself, John DiMaggio, playing both Sandman and Hammerhead, Freddy Krueger himself, Robert Englund, voicing the Vulture. Crispin Freeman as Electro. I don't know if you guys felt this, but Crispin Freeman's Electro sounded a bit like... I'm going to reference the 90s show a lot. Mm-hmm. He kind of sounded like the Peter Parker from the 90s show a little bit to me.
A little it bit, threw yeah. me off. Well, he's Crispin... Bit. I mean, yeah, he's voiced a lot of, like, superhero stuff. Like, he was...
And,
yeah.
And anime stuff, too.
Anime stuff. But he was like Iron Man in Marvel Ultimate Alliance 2.
I think he's Winston in Overwatch.
I think so. He's Roy Harper and like all his clones on Young Justice.
Yeah.
He voiced Superman in Justice League Heroes. That's an underrated game.
Yeah, and for the anime fans out there, he was Alucard from Hellsing and Itachi Uchiha from Naruto. So he's been around.
That he has. And that many of the people on this voice cast. I know I'm talking it up, but for real, this is a very good voice cast. I was shocked at a lot of these names here. We have Darren Norris as J. Jonah Jameson. Vanessa Marshall as Mary Jane Watson. Alana Ubach as Liz Allen. Joshua Labar as Flash Thompson. The man, the myth, the legend, D. Bradley Baker as Dr. Kurt Connors. Ben Diskin as Eddie Brock / Venom. And Deborah Strang as Aunt May. As with the case with a lot of these animated projects, a lot of these voice actors I just named voiced multiple characters. For instance, I think Darren Norris voices both J. Jonah Jameson and John Jameson, Jonah's son.
Mm-hmm.
So there's just a lot of multiple characters going on here for these voice actors. We may mention a few other instances of that.
Yeah, too. Steve Bloom, he does Green Goblin, the Chameleon, and numerous just background characters, and none of them sound the same. It's honestly amazing.
I'm also reasonably sure Clancy Brown voices Captain George Stacy as well. Or detective. He's only a detective in this, right?
Yes.
I don't know. He seemed like the captain of... because he was a... I don't know.
He's called detective in season 2. But he also, like, has the responsibilities of a captain. I think he's, like, special case or something.
And last, but definitely not least, Spider-Man is a character who was originally created by Steve Ditko and Stan Lee. But before we get into our retrospective, let's talk comic connections. Guys, what connections can you make from the comics to Spectacular Spider-Man? Drew, you've been the expert so far. Let's see Tristan take the wheel here.
I mean, pretty much everything about this show. Like this, in terms of Spider-Man adaptations, I would say this is probably A, the most faithful, and B, pulls from the most... like sources. I mean, a lot of it is primarily inspired by like the original like 60s stuff, but then I mean, you see him already bringing in stuff like Venom just in this first season, which doesn't happen until like the 80s. I mean, other side characters like, you know, Kenny King Kong, he's an Ultimate Spider-Man character. Having Gwen and Mary Jane meet Peter in high school, that's, you know, like they're from the college era, but they're already speeding it up and with the high school thing. Like, there is not a single character that I can think of in this that isn't someone that they pulled directly from the comics, except for what about his friend, well, not friend, but what about Sally the cheerleader, Drew, because I can't think of where she's from.
If I remember, Sally from Spectacular Spider-Man, I think from what I remember them saying, because I don't remember her either, but there is a Sally Avril from Earth 616, and she became Bluebird in the comics during the Untold Tales of Spider-Man, if I recall. Actually, now that I remember, they did say 1996, so that's kind of like my birth year. So, but yeah, that's where she first took off. As Bluebird, and she initially appeared back during...
I see what you did there.
Yeah. She apparently appeared in Amazing Fantasy number 15. Like, she was one of the cheerleaders that pretty much just dunked on Peter because he likes science.
But yeah, pretty much every character and the majority of the story arcs are pulled directly from the comics. Like, this is, of all the adaptations of comics that we've done, I feel like this is the hardest one to nail down. Oh, what specifically is from a comic? Because it's the majority of this stuff is, like, every episode's filled with references, even just, you know, to the way Spider-Man lands when he does something.
Or, like, when they're just on certain streets, it's like, oh, that street's one of the authors that wrote Spider-Man for a while. It's like, yeah. Oh. It's like, we can't really, like, pin it down. It's everywhere.
Okay, I got one question, then we can get into our general thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
So, the Batman signal kind of thing Spider-Man has. And I know with MCU, I think they made an Easter egg to it, too, when in Civil War. But is this something that's a little more notable in the comics?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So he actually does have like a bat signal.
Yeah, except he like does it himself.
Yeah, like, and
it's more of a flashlight that he shines at people.
Yeah, it's like he put it on his belt so that way he could have like a recognizable brand going on.
Okay, I just wanted to know that. So let's get into our general thoughts. And real quick, I want to mention again that we are just doing a retrospective on Spectacular Spider-Man Season 1. At the time of this recording, the show is available on Netflix. We're going to have something to say about that. And Netflix in the US too. But it isn't divided into seasons. So we are only going up to episode 13, which is the Season 1 finale, titled Nature vs. Nurture, which, God, I can't wait to talk about that episode. But Drew, you are the person who picked this episode, who recommended it to us. So take it away with your general thoughts.
Just to keep this as concise as possible, this is the best Spider-Man TV show ever. And that's a hard thing for me to say because I love the 90s show. And I'm one of the few people who liked Spider-Man Unlimited, even though like that has its own problems. But in terms of one of the best Spider-Man TV shows, and even like Spider-Man anything besides the comics, this is one of the best things you could ever get into for some Peter Parker goodness. So one of the things I will say is that this takes a lot of inspiration from the comics. Literally every single episode is like paying homage to some of the comics, but also like putting its own spin on it, like the Vulture being the first true supervillain that Spider-Man ever faces, and he's the villain for episode one. Amazing. Then there's like the changes that they make, like instead of the Lizard being semi-intelligent like he is in the comics, it's like he's truly just a force of rage and instinct. Like that's a pretty cool twist on it, and they make it work for the story. Then there's also like bringing in some Spider-Man villains who are technically like B-listers and making them so memorable. Like Shocker. Shocker was not memorable until like the 90s when he got into the Spider-Man TV show in the animated series.
Hey man, let's not talk shit about my boy Herman.
Okay.
I will talk shit about Shocker. Shocker's kind of a joke.
Hey man.
That said, I'm kind of with Drew. This is probably the best Shocker's look outside of the ending of Homecoming, where he got a good lick on Spider-Man.
Then also, just the fact that this is like an ongoing story, but it feels like you could also watch any episode out of order and still have a good, concise story. It's amazing how well they put together this story. It's like, again, I'm going to like leave it off just here, saying that this is one of the best Spider-Man media you can ever get into, and I'm gonna let you guys go into it because I know I'm gonna just keep talking about how great it is and all my favorite moments, so I'm gonna leave like you guys to let you do your thing for now.
I'm gonna quickly go through my general thoughts real quick, Tristan, because I kind of share a lot of the same thoughts as Drew. I'm very nostalgic for the 90s series. I loved it. I'm trying to also remember a lot of it while looking back here at this other show, but I gotta tell you, I haven't seen season two yet. I've only seen up to what we're reviewing here, and again, using that term very loosely, it's up there with the 90s series. This is really fucking good. Like Drew said, if you want some Peter Parker goodness, some of that internal struggle that doesn't feel, again, it's a kid's show. That said, it doesn't feel like overly kiddish at the same time, to where it's just him making the very worst jokes of all time with not the best voice acting and all that stuff. It's the opposite of that. Like, the jokes are actually pretty decent sometimes. The Peter Parker struggles are very what you would expect from a great Spider-Man story. The villains are very good. I have a little bit of issues with some of the villains and also their designs. I'm not a big fan of the design, the animation style. But overall, this series has been really damn good so far. And especially because it caps off with one of my favorite Spider-Man stories I've ever seen, with the Venom symbiote arc that they do with Eddie.
Yeah, I disagree with you on the animation style and looks, but it's personal preference there. And everything. Yeah. But I do like how you brought up the villains and stuff, you know. since, like, the villains are on the rise, the city is victimized. Looking up Windows of Prize, arriving in the speed of time.
Just throughout the podcast. But, Tristan, what are your general thoughts?
This show's a fucking banger. Like, yeah. When you said, oh, well, let me go first because I'm going to share a lot of thoughts with Drew. Yeah, same. I think this is probably the best Spider-Man adaptation, I would go as far as say, at least in terms of animation. I mean, I enjoy the 90s show as much as the next guy, but I've also been rewatching it since they put it on Disney Plus. Like, it's a great show, but something...
There was some limitations.
There were some limitations. They had limitations.
Not their fault.
Not their fault. Yeah, it's, well, yeah. I don't know. Some of the voice actors' fault a little bit.
You couldn't say kill. You had to say, like, oh, they're going to waste them or something like that. And nobody could really die or anything like that.
And some of the performances, a bit over the top and cheesy, like we can admit. Yeah. But, you know, there's a style of the time. But I don't know, man.
Shocker! This is just
like that. Yeah. This, I don't know, man. It's just, it's what we talked about where this feels like, yeah, it's a kid show, but this is still something that we're watching as adults. And we're like, oh, man, like, this really holds up. And, you know, like I said, I've been rewatching the 90s Spider-Man and I still enjoy it. But there is a lot of them like, okay, yeah, this is more for children than, you know, I'd like to admit. I'd say if we're ranking in terms of maturity, Spectacular Spider-Man, then Spider-Man Animated Series, Ultimate Spider-Man, just dead last down at the bottom, just in 6 feet underground.
That's why I wanted to say nostalgically.
Yeah.
Because I think part of it is I look back, and I'm not trying to, like, trash this animated series, the 90s series, because it's iconic, and it should be. That the X-Men series did so much for Marvel back in the 90s that I don't think they properly get the respect they deserve, even though we're getting the X-Men series back, which is great. But going into this series, I agree with you. I just think there's a certain level of them trying to tell the story of this kid who's struggling with money. He's struggling and trying to help his family and be friends with people and try to being a teenager. And also taking that responsibility to be Spider-Man. And that story is just so fucking good every time it's told. And you look back at that 90s series, as much as I love some of the arcs, I actually didn't mind the Clone Saga in that series. I actually thought it was solid. Same thing with the Secret Wars and all the other ones that they've done. But I think that's what I take from those, is I remember the awesome arcs they do in the crossovers. But there's, like you said, Tristan, I'm pretty sure I go back and watch some of them, and it's just like, ah, that's a time of the 90s to where it's so over the top, and when we were kids, we loved it. But now you're watching it in your 20s, and you're like,
ooh, that's, like, that didn't age well.
I still love this show. It's the 90s, all right?
Yeah. I think this is the best show to explore Peter's duality: with great power comes great responsibility, and the different responsibilities that hold up in, like, the animated verse. Because we see him, like, oh, like you said, he had the money troubles and everything. He had trying to be a teenager. He wants to have some of that selfishness, but then that's like that selfishness also ties into his life, his friendships, and all that. This is the series where if you are truly trying to see a Spider-Man that grapples with great power comes great responsibility, and how that affects his everyday life and not in cheap ways, this is it.
I would agree. I would sign off on that statement.
I would too. I think another reason I would sign off on it is because we have such a great voice cast, like we talked about earlier. I gotta say, Josh Keaton as Spider-Man, this dude fucking crushed it. By the end of the season, when we're getting into the alien costume arc and the Venom stuff, and where you get Peter trying to be a little emo, a little edgier.
Just a little bit.
He nails it.
Nails it.
Fucking just nails it perfectly to where it's like, it's edgy enough to where it's like, oh, this is, it's what you would think Peter would be like with the suit. But it's not so much so where you're, and it feels like we're going to be comparing a lot of things here, but I'm saying this also lovingly. It's not so much edginess like the Tobey Maguire in Spider-Man 3.
Where he's, you mean Bully Maguire?
Sidewalk. Yeah. And I think it's also natural to do these comparisons and stuff, so I'm not going to hate on myself too much for it. But Josh Keaton fucking crushed it here. This is a great cast from top to bottom, especially in the villains. Robert Englund as the Vulture is a name that I keep looking at, and I'm like, I wouldn't be mad to see that in live action. I love Michael Keaton. Michael Keaton destroyed that role until he was in Morbius.
I mean,
which also wasn't his fault. That's
something related to that role got destroyed. Could it have been all the credibility? Potentially.
Yeah, probably so. I feel very bad because he did such an amazing job in Homecoming. But
I mean, Taylor, I think it's got something to do with Spider-Man. Not sure though.
by the way, a little trivia for you. So in Young Justice, many people might recognize that there was also a Spider-Man-esque villain in that show named Black Spider, and he is also voiced by Josh Keaton. And this was actually done on purpose because apparently even the DC people working on Young Justice back then were like, bring back Spectacular Spider-Man. And that's the reason why they put Josh Keaton as Black Spider. Even the whole reason Black Spider's even in Young Justice.
That's pretty cool. But yeah, man, I keep looking. It's just, you look at the Sinister Six, I even forgot, okay, here's how awesome this show was to me. I have the notes I wrote down for the first episode. The characters they introduce, and they do a pretty good job of introducing all their characters. And what's up my light, too, is they don't beat you over the head with, here's their introduction. They give you, a hint that Eddie and Peter have been friends for a long time. And then at the end of the season, we learn a little more and a little more. It doesn't beat you over the head with, a flashback or an origin story. And you learn why they've been friends for so long, and it makes so much fucking sense. I love the way they do the storytelling there. But you have Eddie introduced. You have Adrian Toomes. You have Norman Osborn. Gwen Stacy. Harry Osborn. Kurt Connors. I don't know if I already mentioned him. Otto Octavius, I think, is in this episode. J. Jonah Jameson. I don't even think I'm done. There's another character, too. I think Tombstone is not mentioned, but teased. I think the same thing with Hammerhead. I'm not totally sure on those two, though.
Yes.
But so many characters. And then they do the same thing throughout the entire season. For them to handle that so well. And then the voice cast just crush it, man. Just excellent execution from the entire crew. But what do you guys think of the voice cast?
Honestly, these are some of the best voices for these characters to bring them to life. It's like whenever I hear J. Jonah Jameson, also gotta put this in, best J. Jonah Jameson in animation, no question.
I will say no question. We can't, RIP to Ed Asner. He was pretty damn good.
He was, but I can't. So whenever I hear J. Jonah Jameson in the comics, whenever I'm reading a comic, this is the J. Jonah Jameson voice I hear. And I also think, as far as a J. Jonah, this is I'm not going to say this is the best J. Jonah in animation, because the 90s J. Jonah actually had some pretty good stuff. But he's it's so close. It is neck and neck with these two.
It's a real competition. Yeah, I'm not trying to discount how great J. Jonah Jameson is in this, because he is fantastic, but got to put respect on Ed Asner.
Yeah.
I do love, I think it helps too when the characterization is right with Jonah.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the adaptations, which has been, I think, I don't know about Ultimate, because I didn't get that far. But yeah, especially the 90s series did it, Spectacular Spider-Man did it, and the Raimi series did it so far. To where J. Jonah Jameson, he's an asshole. But when chips are down, he will be a good guy. He'll protect the people close to him, especially Peter. And that's something it's a really cool trait that they don't really harp on. It's just there, and the audience knows it.
Mm-hmm. With all the different other characters as well, there are some characters in here that, honestly, before Tom Holland, I started to care about these characters a lot more. Because before this series, I did not care about Liz Allen. I did not care about Sally Avril or most of the side characters that are in this, besides of course the core of them, Harry Osborn, Gwen Stacy, Flash Thompson, all of that. In this series, when they said Liz was going to be the first love interest of Peter in Spider-Man Homecoming, I was like, hell yeah, because of this series, because Liz Allen became something I cared about from this series and everything. And you see her character growth. It's they give such good character growth to her from this series. It's before, she starts out easily as one of the most dislikable characters besides Sally. And then they keep going, and you see her she starts getting respect for Peter. She starts, like, seeing things from his point of view and being nicer and getting to know him. It's, like, it's all so good. The characters in this, so good.
I'm glad you reminded me of Liz and Flash Thompson, because those are two other characters who introduced alongside, I forgot this, because this was, I think, the first two criminals Peter beats up, is the pre-superpowered Sandman and Rhino.
Yep, Alex O'Hearn as Rhino and Flint Marko as Sandman. This was also the series that got me to remember their names outside of their superhero names, supervillain names. I mean,
well, that's the thing. Don't they they change Rhino's name for this show because they Americanize him? Because in the comics, he was originally a Russian guy, and his name was Alexei Sexevich.
You see, that's what threw me off. I thought it was going to be a Russian name, and it wasn't.
Yeah, so, in this one, he is fully Americanized. He is not from Russia, and he's. Like, he's not at, like, okay, so this is the thing about Rhino's mischaracterization in the comics. Sometimes Rhino's as dumb as a bricks. Other times it's like he actually has semi-intelligence. Apparently he knows a lot about Rhino physiology for some reason, even though, like, he was turned to the Rhino against his will. But it's weird characterization with him sometimes. This one, he's just simplistic. That's the thing. He's not dumb. He's just simplistic.
Not only that, though. I just want to say the crew in this show, especially the writing staff, to add all these characters throughout the seasons, and for me not to be like, you just shoehorned them in, just excellent execution across the board. There's so many characters here, man. What'd you say, Tristan?
I said, you mean rhino-horned them in?
The rhino-horned them in. None of the characters feel like that. Even whenever we get to the later episodes and you get... I even forgot to include them on our outline here because there's so many characters. Who is it? It is Chameleon, a pre-Mysterio, and a pre-Tinker.
Mm-hmm.
All in an episode. And they all feel like they belong there. And that's the biggest thing. Is while a person like me who's sitting there, I'm like, oh, I would know who that is. I think if somebody's just watching the show and doesn't know everything about Spider-Man, they'd still get a lot of enjoyment out of it to where you don't have to know everything, but it's really cool Easter eggs to where you're like, that might pay off later. That might pay off later. Knowing the show only has two seasons, it makes me also feel pretty sad because I know not all of it will, but yeah. Still.
Well, some of it will get paid off. I promise you when we get into season two, you'll see some of it pay off.
Not Tristan, enough of it. I want to go ahead and get your thoughts on this next story or this next topic here. Mm-hmm. So, Josh Keaton, we talked about him already, and how great he is as Peter Parker and Spider-Man. What are your thoughts on this adaptation of Spider-Man?
I mean, it's like I've said, I think it's the most faithful. It's probably my favorite adaptation of Spider-Man, because I do love Spider-Man PS4. It's neck and neck for me. It's definitely the most faithful, like I've said, and in that sense, I really, really do appreciate it. But it's now I'm torn because now I'm thinking about Spider-Man PS4. I think I'm gonna have to put this above Spider-Man PS4 as probably my favorite Spider-Man like adaptation.
It's also different.
It is different.
And not just different as in like, oh, for example, I'm not trying to compare the two. I'm just compared to two in quality. I'm just comparing the two and how they are.
Yeah,
and the MCU was in high school. And Spectacular Spider-Man is also in high school.
Yeah.
So you could theoretically also compare those. I feel like it is different to be like the 25-year-old Peter in Spider-Man PS4 who's been at it for 10 years compared to the guy who just started out, it seems to be, about a year or two ago.
Yeah. Oh, also, Tristan, I'm glad you said Spider-Man PS4 because when I was playing Spider-Man PS4, I felt like it was sort of a spiritual sequel to... Spectacular Spider-Man, with how they treat Pete and his, like, the way he has to delve with responsibility versus what he wants and everything. It's like, it's obviously not a sequel everything because Ock is a good guy beginning
Mary Jane is not the same Mary Jane.
Yeah, definitely.
I prefer Spectacular Spider-Man Mary Jane, but that's just me.
Yeah, but I do feel like Spider-Man PS4 is kind of like a spiritual successor. Like, they were like, oh, let's take some Spectacular Spider-Man stuff and put it in Spider-Man PS4.
I mean, sure, but I will say, like, you're a Spider-Man fan. Him juggling his responsibilities, that's kind of the whole crux of Spider-Man, period, you know?
True that.
But while we're on the subject, though, of little comparisons, and we were talking about the MCU here. I do think, and let me know what you guys think about this. This isn't even on a rundown. I think Sony and Marvel could really take a look at this show going into Tom Holland's college years. Mm-hmm. I think they can adapt a lot of this, and it'd be fucking phenomenal.
They could.
Especially the Eddie Venom stuff.
I see, and I'm curious. I'm curious, how would the Eddie Venom... I don't know how well the Eddie Brock...
I'm not sure about stuff. Old friends, yeah, kind of thing, but I think you could do the... Eddie's working with Kurt Connors, yeah, instead of being just a brute. See, that's the big thing about just Eddie, to where I'd never really known about his characterization, because he always comes off as the meathead dude who just gets the suit and he's fucking ripped.
Yeah.
And in this show, yeah, he's a big dude, but he has a characterization, and...
And it's a... And another thing of pulling from the comics, this Eddie Brock characterization pulls heavily from the Ultimate Spider-Man. Like, physically, he's built similar to the traditional Eddie Brock we see in the 616, but in terms of, like, oh, he and Peter's dad, like, worked together, like, they were old friends, he was a bit older, he got the symbiote after, like, he felt Peter fucked him over, like, you know, that's very Ultimate Spider-Man.
Yeah. We'll bring up my literal only problem with Eddie Brock in this is the fact that always gets me a lot when Eddie Brock gets the costume after Spider-Man and everything is Eddie gets Peter's memories and the difficult decisions he sees through the symbiote. And my question always, and I mean always, is, okay, Eddie, you have now Peter's point of view. You have him making those decisions and trying to make the best decision for everyone, including knowing that Peter was the one to save Kurt Connors from being the Lizard, meaning that he wasn't just taking pictures, he was actually risking his life to save Connors. He has all the information now, knowing that Peter was trying to be a good friend to him, and knowing that he was trying to protect him. Why are you immediately on murder spree?
I want to get into the whole symbiote suit story later, to be honest, which, so I'm going to save my answer, but I do have an answer.
I also have an answer.
So please remember that question.
Then we'll save that for later.
Quick, just give me a quick answer for both of you here. Feelings on animation. So my big complaint here, and this is just personal preference, I didn't really care for a lot of the designs, mainly Doc Ock. I didn't really like his suit too much.
Oh, man.
I kind of liked Electro's.
Electro's
was really good.
Yeah.
But there was a lot of suit designs I didn't care for as much. What did you guys think of the animation in general? Again, it's nothing due to the quality. Quality was really good. It's just my personal preference. Yeah. It wasn't for me.
Making this quick so Tristan can do his. Love these designs. Only design, I think, in the show that I ever had a small problem with was Vulture. And that's only because he's not green.
Yeah, and I'm in the same boat as Drew. And I think the reason why they went with red and black is there was... Like, Vulture did eventually get a costume in the comics that was red and black. But, I mean, he's since gone back to the green. Like, because that's what everyone recognizes when it comes to the Vulture. But no, I enjoy all these designs for the most part. I can't think of one that really sticks out to me as being like, nah, I don't care for it. Personally, I love Doc Ock's design. I was thinking about that when I was finishing watching it earlier today. I like his little goggles.
Yeah.
Let's talk about some of the best episodes here, because we had 13 episodes. We're not going to be able to talk about all of them specifically. What are the best episodes, in your opinion, of season one? Drew, let's start with you. You got a list of them, by the way. I can send them over to you if you don't.
I know them by heart. I also know that the first three are named after notions of biology, next three are economics, and the following three are chemistry, with the final four being psychology, being the theme of their episode names. Getting into that sciencey side of Peter, which I love. As for best episodes, obviously Intervention, Nature versus Nurture, the two episodes that are basically the season finale, are some of the best. Group Therapy is also good because we get the Sinister Six. Survival of the Fittest is a great introduction and honestly sticks with me to this day. All of them are really good. Like I said, all of them are just so good.
I would rather, we're going to talk about worst episodes, but I'm kind of with you to where I don't want to say necessarily terrible or bad.
It's like
just meh episodes. There's like two or three meh episodes to me. Everything else is top tier. When this show hits, it hits.
Yeah, man. I think it's like my feelings with Avatar: The Last Airbender. There's no real episode I hate. it's like, you can say there's the worst episode, but it's like, even then, it's like, hey, you're not gonna dislike it, in all honesty. So, I'm gonna leave it there, because then I'm gonna go through the entire 13 episodes list.
I would say favorite episodes, obviously, you know, the final two episodes with the whole Venom saga. I mean, come on. Like, they're fantastic. My personal favorite, I would say, is Group Therapy, just because I love anytime the Sinister Six gets together, and seeing a, you know, unconscious Peter go apeshit on all of them, it's like, man. Like, Spider-Man is serious when he's not talking. You're like, oh, the bad guys are fucked up now. But, you know, seeing him be asleep when fucking dudes up is always going to be the coolest thing. And just the interplay between the villains. That's, I mean, Spider-Man has one of the best rogues galleries in comics. So anytime you can see them bouncing off one another is fantastic. And I'd say this is probably one of my favorite adaptations of the Sinister Six. And I'm glad, you know, little spoiler alert for season two, you will see, you know, a Sinister Six again. So very much looking forward to that.
Yeah, by the way, listeners, we're going to be talking about the villain specifically. We're going to try to just skim through episodes, our best and least favorite. And then we'll go into our villains and what we think of them and all that stuff. So
yeah,
we're not just going to skim through everything and go to the end.
Yeah, I also want to bring up, since Tristan mentioned it, kudos on this being currently the only adaptation with the Venom symbiote that has the taking Peter's body out for a joyride subplot, because that is in the original story. It never has been translated into an adaptation.
So. Well, they do it. They hint at it in Spider-Man 3 for a bit, because remember, he, like, the suit, like, latches onto him, and, like, it does the zoom in on his eye, and he wakes up, and he's on the side of a building.
See, I always thought, like, with that, that was showing, like, Peter waking up in the suit, and he went out with the suit to the building. That was always my interpretation, so I didn't really think that it was, you know, taking him for a joyride, especially since it never happens again. And it's never brought up explicitly, so you might be right.
I mean, he when they cut to that scene, I mean, obviously this is not a Spider-Man 3 podcast, but when they cut to him on the side of the building, he, like, starts looking at his hands like he's just now seeing, like, noticing what's happened. And then he starts flexing, like, oh shit, like, I feel awesome. Like, that feels like something he would have thought of while he was swinging there, you know, if he had been conscious.
True that.
As for me, favorite episodes, I really like Catalyst, which I believe is the first time Peter meets Mary Jane, which I loved the way they handled that the entire first half of the season, because the audience knows who May's.
You know she's going to be a smoke show.
It's just like, yeah, and the audience knows, like, Peter, you're a fucking moron. Just, you know, just don't listen to yourself. Listen to your aunt. Just go and date with girl next door. And then he finally sees her at the end of the last episode, and then Catalyst is where we finally get to see the two interact, and I just thought it was great. Plus, this is the episode where I believe we get the first appearance of the Green Goblin.
We do.
But, like you guys, the Venom saga, I can't wait till we get to that, because this is probably one of my favorite Spider-Man medias ever, is how they handle that. I love the episode with the lizard. I don't remember what it's called off the top of my head. I'm trying to
Natural Selection
up here. Natural Selection, I love that one because it showed kind of what we were talking about before with the tone of the show being pretty good, to where it showed Peter legit fail. Like, he saves he saves Kurt Connors and everything, but he fails his friends. He makes the wrong decision.
Classic Spider-Man.
Which is, like, you're right, Tristan. Classic Spider-Man. It's fucking perfect. And, of course, Group Therapy. Seeing the Sinister Six. I'm a little mixed feelings on the whole Peter defeating the Sinister Six unconscious thing. It feels very Moon Knight, which I have also mixed feelings about that. Like, I respect the hell out of that decision, by the way, in the finale.
At least we get to see the fight.
You do get to see the fight. That's the good thing. But at the same time, I'm like, fuck, this feels like something Peter should have to go through to struggle to beat. And the fact that the symbiote does it, yeah, we'll get to it. I have mixed feelings because it's so badass, though, at the same time. Which is why I kind of made the comparison there. But getting into least favorite episodes, I only have really one. And I would say it's the episode where Peter is asking out Betty Brant.
Oh, the you one mean, with the yeah. You,
yeah, the Rhino one. It was fine. It was meh. It was okay. It felt like the that story with Peter and Betty was really taking the spotlight, and it was just wasn't really feeling it compared to, like, Peter has a lot of love interest in this season,
as he does in the comics.
Yeah, I mean, he is known as this. He's known as a superhero who has the most ladies in his life.
And so, you know, he shouldn't really be complaining too much about that. That said, this episode was like, let's add another one. And I was like, really? We have three love interests already. Is that not enough for this one season?
No,
it's like, no, we need more.
And Sally is an anti-love interest at best. No one likes Sally.
It's more of a hate interest.
Yeah.
And my other least favorite, and this is the one y'all are going to hate me for. I apologize. The Invisible Hand, which is the intro to Doc Ock.
You're a hater. That's not the Invisible Hand.
You're a fucking hater.
Oh, I'm sorry.
The introduction to Doc Ock is Reaction.
Okay, there it is. Yeah, Reaction. I'm sorry. I was reading a synopsis. That was wrong. My bad.
Hater. Which we need to call out. We need to call out Netflix. Why are all their synopses
Let's
wrong?
Talk about it.
Let's just go ahead and talk
I have
about
an answer.
It.
I have an answer to this.
Please give it to me.
If you're on Netflix and you're watching this show, you're going to read some descriptions. And when you watch the show, you're going to be like, that didn't happen. Human Torch is referenced in the description. He's not in this show. The Kingpin is referenced. Not in this show. The reason I think why this happened, and this is solely from me looking at Reddit for about 2 minutes, is that it was from the first draft of a script and everything, so it's all their first drafts of stuff, so they were going to originally use Kingpin, they were going to originally have other characters, they eventually weren't able to use other characters, so that's what it appears to be. So Netflix is just using that version for some reason.
That fits. It's weird because I remember Greg Wiseman said that those didn't even make it to scripts. So the fact that they had the synopsis for those is a bit weird. But
that's strange. It's curious.
Still, it threw me off to where I had to message you both in the group chat. I was like, am I crazy?
Yeah, no. When I had to do a double take when I was like, wait a second. Human Torch doesn't show up in the show. And this was even before I got to the episode. I clicked on it, and I was like, Human Torch isn't in this show.
Like, I started thinking about the football scenes, because that was the episode, I think. And I was like, is the Human Torch supposed to be one of the football players trying out? I was about to go back through and watch it. I was just like, there's no way that they're this wrong. They are that wrong.
They're that wrong.
So the Netflix descriptions, if for some reason you haven't seen the show yet and you're listening to us, just don't even bother reading them. Go into the episode blind. Yeah, before I turn it over to both of you with the least favorite episodes, the whole reason I didn't care for the Doc Ock one is just because he comes back later and kind of fixes my issue with it. But he basically goes from, I'm the underling villain, to I'm going to kill everybody like that. And it is kind of weird. And I know it's a cartoon, they have 30 minutes and they're trying to do that, but a lot of villains kind of feel similarly. So that kind of threw me off, and plus he was a one-off villain until he came back with Sinister Six. So I think that's why I would put that episode in the least favorite. But other than that, every other episode, honestly, was a banger, especially like the last four.
I mean, to be fair, Spider-Man 2, Otto's like, I'm gonna just be the best scientist. This science is a gift, a privilege for the world. And then he goes to, I'm gonna murder Spider-Man and yeet Peter Parker out a window and kidnap this red-headed woman. Like... Yeah, it's kind of a Doc Ock thing.
Yeah, and it's not like that it's, like, totally his fault. It's, like, in the episode when he's introduced as fully Dr. Octopus, in Reaction, it's, like, it's after the accidental explosion energy thing that he starts acting that way. It's, like, it seems like it has affected his mind. They're trying to go into the Spider-Man 2 thing of, oh, the arms might be affecting his mind to a degree, or maybe the accident did it. Who knows?
And he's got a complex because of Norman Osborn.
Mm-hmm. That's why I'm going with the time frame of the episode is really where I think that if they had more time to go into, okay, here's Doc Ock devolving into insanity, they probably would have, but they felt pretty content, obviously, with just being like, well, we're going to bring him back later. It's fine. He's going to go kind of crazy in this first episode. Then he'll be the Doc Ock, you know, love and remember for being that mastermind there in the Sinister Six, which I greatly appreciate. But what are you guys' least favorite episodes of this season? Tristan, let's start with you.
I'm trying to think. The episode where Montana becomes a shocker. I'm like, all right. You know, it's not Herman Schultz, so why do I give a shit? You know? Let me think. The other, also, I'm not crazy about the first episode, the Vulture episode. Just because Vulture, not really, I mean, you know, Robert Englund, great. But just not really a villain that does it for me, generally. So I'm like, oh, okay, he's fighting the Vulture. Great. Like,
I can understand. So you're talking
about Survival of the Fittest and Market Forces.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Are the two episodes.
I'm like, those are fine. Like, they're not bad, obviously. Like we said, even the worst episode is still pretty entertaining, like, you know, animation.
I'm not saying this to, like, pump up the show. Like, sometimes I feel like we give, I don't want to say fake enthusiasm, but we're more positive. I kind of just genuinely do think all these episodes, except for a few, are just amazing. I'm not saying that for a pun.
Like, at the least, like, they're solid. Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah, that's what I'm saying. The base is, like, it's average.
Yeah.
The ceiling is it's a 10 out of 10 episode. This show is very underrated, people. If you haven't seen it yet, go fucking watch
it. Go watch Spectacular Spider-Man. Stop listening to us.
Yeah, go watch it.
That's maybe a podcasting sin we're committing. We should never tell anybody to stop listening to us. So know that when we commit that podcasting sin, it's for a reason.
It's for a damn good reason. A spectacular reason, dare I say.
Love it.
Drew, what are your least favorite episodes?
I'm only going to say one, and that is Reaction with Dr. Octopus. Reason being is that, like most of the stuff, it's a solid episode. Love it. Only thing is that after saving Otto, it's like suddenly he's just, oh, you tried to kill me and everything.
That's what I'm saying.
And it's like
I get it, but
yeah, it's,
I get what they're doing. It's just that, like I said, the time of it is like it felt like they wanted 10 more minutes to go into that story, but no, we gotta do it now. All right, well, it's fine enough.
It's just one of those things that I never like. The misunderstanding when the evidence is very much against it is one of those things that I just do not like in any medium whatsoever. It's like, oh, I saved your life. You were trying to kill me. Wait, what?
I mean, yeah, but they did set it up by being like, dude, like, Spider-Man's gonna track us down. He's gonna track this shit back to me. And I was like, that's not gonna happen. And then, you know, he gets in an accident, Spider-Man's there, and he's already, like, kind of crazy. I don't know, it worked for me.
Yeah, it works. It's not saying that it doesn't still work. It's just not one of my favorite things. I'm reaching here. Like I said, I like every episode.
Yeah.
See, that's what I'm saying. I think it's fine. It's just, for a show that I think executes all their stories so well, it's the one that stands out that's like, could have used a little more time in the oven.
Mm-hmm.
But let's get into the villains, because Tristan, you mentioned that Spider-Man has one of the best rogues galleries.
I did mention that.
All of comics. And some would say he might just have the best.
Yeah, I don't know if I got
that.
Am
I that person?
I'd say Spider-Man has the second best, just under Batman. And the reason I say it is because
that's Batman's a clash of the stash right there.
Yeah, the reason we'll have our own clash, but I'm just gonna say my minor reason and be done with it. The minor reason I say it is because for Batman, a lot of his rogues are reflections of certain aspects of his personality. Like Mr. Freeze is the cold determination of Batman, and then you have the thrill seeking of it, which was Catwoman, who, by the way, for anyone who doesn't know, they're officially married now. Like, they got married. No joke.
Yeah, but Batman Catwoman's not in continuity.
It isn't?
No.
Dang it, no! I retract my last statement, I'm sorry. Ah!
Wow, Drew is recuperating again. Let's talk about
it. Side note, wait, right, real quick, so I can contribute to the stash. I would argue that the X-Men have the best villains, but that's just me.
No, so we're going to get a triple threat. Yeah, triple threat here.
Okay, you guys heard it here. A triple threat clash of the stash. Me, Tristan, and Taylor all fighting to convince one person.
God help whoever judges that thing. God, that sounds like a nightmare.
I know, right? I can't wait.
Let's talk about our villains here. We got, I'm just going to name them off because there's a lot of villains, and then we can go from whichever one you guys want to talk about first. We got the Lizard, We got Tombstone as the looming threat, somewhat like Kingpin was in the 90s animated series. We got the Green Goblin. We got the alien costume itself, which is the symbiote. We got the Sinister Six, which is Doc Ock, Elektra, Vulture, Rhino, Shocker, and the Sandman. We also got Venom, and I don't have them here on this list because I forgot about them. And that's not to say they were bad, they were great. It's just there's so many villains. We had Chameleon, we had a pre-Mysterio Quentin Beck, and a pre-Tinker, I forgot the guy's name off the top of my head.
Phineas Mason.
Mm-hmm.
Phineas Mason. So
we also got the Enforcers. Can't forget about the Enforcers.
And don't forget about Black Cat.
Like Black Cat is, yeah, I always think of Black Cat as kind of like an anti-hero.
She kind of is, but in this one, she is a thief. Her whole deal is she likes to steal stuff, and even though she helps out Spider-Man, she's doing it mostly to get what she wants. So I'm putting her down as a villain.
Okay, so here's who I want to start with. And earlier in this podcast, I talked about, I think the MCU could use some stuff from this and take it into their college trilogy. One of those things is with how they treat Tombstone as this looming threat. I think in the MCU, it would be Kingpin, just because they'd rather use the established villain they've already created. But there's something I got a kick out of it. I was just getting giddy. How Doc Ock was breaking, Doc Ock and Electro were breaking all these villains out. I'm like, oh shit, we're getting Sinister Six. And then we learn that they're being funded by the Tombstone. And I was just like, oh shit, this is going to be fucking awesome. And it was a great episode. What did you guys think of Sinister Six?
Well, Sinister Six or Tombstone?
I guess both, really, because I feel like they're kind of connected because of that reason.
Well, both are highlights of the show for me, personally.
Yes.
Like, obviously, Tombstone in general is a fucking dope character, and Kevin Michael Richardson like kills it. It's I mean, all that's left is the Tombstone, you know, like how Hammerhead said, you know, when he got, you know, kidnapped by Green Goblin. But no, Tombstone's great.
That is such a killer line.
It's such a killer line. You're like, oh shit, like, that's hard as fuck. That's raw as fuck for a kid's cartoon. You're like, Jesus, like I don't want to fuck with. He's the big man. I don't want to fuck with Tombstone. He's great. I love his machinations. I love how he's one of those characters where it's like, you know, he talks a lot of shit and people are scared of him, but like for good reason, because he can actually back it up. Like you can tell this isn't just some dude who's like been doing some white collar crime and now he's dipping his toes in. Like, no, his fucking Tombstone, he has worked his way up from the bottom. And which, you know, as a fun little tie-in, the most recent debut arc of the current ongoing Amazing Spider-Man series by Zeb Wells and Jaramita Jr. had Tombstone as the primary villain for the first arc, and man, God, Tombstone, just great guy. Not great guy, but great villain. As for the Sinister Six,
what a great guy.
What a great guy, Lonnie Thompson.
What a great fella. All the murders, destroying families. Hey, not to mention
he's an entrepreneur.
Everybody has their bad days.
He's just trying to make a buck, honest or otherwise. As for the Sinister Six, it's like I was saying when I was talking about group therapy. Like they're great. I love the interplay. I love personally Doc Ock in this. I would like to see them translate this version of Doc Ock to the MCU. I don't know how they'll do that now that he's already. It you know raises the question that we've talked about, and we did talk about it more, I think, with the No Way Home retrospective of. Or not retrospective, spoiler talk, I should say, of whether or not these villains that Peter has already met, will we see them again in the MCU, or are these just the versions we're going to get? So, will we see, you know, Doc Ock or Electro or you know, Sandman show up as variants in the prime MCU universe, or will we just never see them again? I don't know.
But I think we'll see Goblin.
I do think we'll see Goblin again. If they do the Green Goblin, though, I think they need to do it like the ultimate route, where he's almost large and like he's large and almost Hulk-like, just because I feel mutated. Like that would really differentiate it. Yeah, a mutated freak, and God, he's so fucking cool. You can still have that weird obsession, and I think that would play into Peter being terrified of him because he knows what he's capable of, but I digress. But really, the Sinister Six in general in this show, both as individuals and when they finally show up as a unit, like I think these are all fantastic adaptations, and it's rife for inspiration for other Spider-Man adaptations, be they, you know, live action or in video games or also animated.
Drew, what are your thoughts on Tombstone and the Sinister Six?
I told you that this was where I started caring about a lot of Spider-Man's villains a lot more. This is where Tombstone became an actual threat to me. When he shows up and he beats up Spider-Man, no problem. It's like he is basically just talking down to a kid. And, ew, my God, it's so cool. It just makes him such a awesome threat and everything. And I know that Kingpin does it, but in this one, because they're not dealing with Kingpin's girth, they're not afraid of making him fast, and they take advantage of his granite-like skin very well. He gets one of the goblin slashers in his shoulder, and he's like, that's annoying, and then just throws it away. It's so awesome. I also love how calm he remains no matter what situation he is in. It is, he is one of those people you don't want to be in a room with. And the Sinister Six, I will always love. It's like, I always like it when Peter is fighting all six at once. Because every time he faces a Sinister Six all at once, he is doing everything he can. He cannot make a single mistake or he is dead. And it just so works here. I understand, like, with the Moon Knight thing with you, Taylor, how, he is unconscious. But that's kind of the whole point of the Venom symbiote. Like, it's taking his body out for joyrides. It's also, like, draining him of energy. Well, I guess not this one, but in most other stuff, it's supposed to be draining him of energy as well as empowering him. It's like a double-edged sword. And it just works so well for me. I love the Sinister Six. I love Doc Ock acting such in control, the confidence, and adapting some of Norman's personality in this new evil persona. It just fits so much. Group Therapy is one of my favorite episodes of all Spider-Man media. Like, literally one of my favorite stories of all Spider-Man media. It works so well. And I also love the fact that when Spider-Man has to beat them, he's using some of their powers against each other. Love it. Creative solutions to hard problems.
So the first thing I want to mention, I want to talk about Tombstone first. And you mentioned that he's a threat a lot like Kingpin, and I talked about that before. I don't think that's necessarily... I think some people will look at that and being like, oh, just use Kingpin. I would much rather do something like the show did and bump up Tombstone to where more people can see how badass the character could be. Because that means down the line you could have Tombstone and Kingpin on this kind of gang war threat. And that's really fucking cool. I would love to see that. And I think we get a little bit in the PS4 game of that, don't we? With Kingpin and Tombstone? Not to this extent.
Well, I mean, Kingpin's already, like, locked up at the beginning, but Tombstone is, like, you do see him making power plays.
Yeah.
Yeah. And to which we don't even get Kingpin in this show, but I'm saying, like, they have that potential to be like, yeah, everybody knows Kingpin. He's the big motherfucker who's awesome. But this guy over here, Tombstone, he's pretty fucking awesome too. So I'm really glad this show didn't go with Kingpin for whatever reason, whether it was something that they actually planned to do and decided to scrap it, or Netflix is just completely fucking wrong and they didn't watch the show when they're writing these descriptions.
No, regardless. Like, Kingpin was originally, like, slated for the show. They couldn't use him. And when they changed to Tombstone, they made him more of a physical threat because Kingpin was not supposed to be a pure physical threat in the original tellings.
Yeah. So that's what I'm saying. I'm really glad they went with Tombstone because, to me, I always liked Tombstone, but this show made it to where, okay, he went up a few notches for me. He kind of does come across as he could be a potential threat in a Spider-Man movie or something like that. So I think they did a great job with him. The Sinister Six, I've already talked about, I didn't care for Doc Ock's intro as much, even though it's still fine. But this episode, it pretty much was like, all right, well, we're going to fix that and we're going to pretty much make this one of the best episodes of the entire show. And it definitely was. I loved it. I just have mixed feelings on the Peter not being the one to defeat the Sinister Six. Like I said, on one hand, I wanted it to be Peter physically having to go through and beat all six of them. That said, like Tristan mentioned before, the no jokes, completely silent, the symbiote suit beating the fuck out of Sinister Six was so badass. So I don't really know where to go there with it. Overall, though, I love these villains. Doc Ock was great. Electro was really good. Rhino, Shocker, and Sandman, they were what they were, which is why I think they worked so much in the Sinister Six. And Vulture as well would couple in there. I feel like this is a team, although I really liked them, I think they could have used one more star character in there. But overall, this was a really good episode. Moving on, though, let's talk about the Green Goblin.
Let's talk about that Green Goblin.
So, I thought this was going to be Norman for a long time. I thought it was somehow going to be Norman, and Twist wasn't going to make sense. And then about when Harry started passing out and shit, I was just like, oh yeah, it's going to be Harry. The way they handled this was really well done this season. Because I have a feeling that they're going to bring this back up again, and it's going to be Norman. But what did you guys think of this?
I love the relation with Green Goblin and Pete. Because, oh my god, the back and forth witty banter is amazing. I mean, it was like Peter is asking, is that a felony? And then Green Goblin replies, well, I hope so. I would never be caught doing a misdemeanor. It's like, oh, so good. Oh my god. I love it. I love the Green Goblin just doing his menacing stuff and his voice. His voice is awesome. It is not the voice I hear when I read Green Goblin, but it still just works so well.
I think the Green Goblin in this is, I mean, again, it's one of the best adaptations. And I think part of that is because the way they treat Harry and, like, I mean, it's a kid's cartoon, so they can't fully delve into, like, his issues with addiction and whatnot. But, like, that is a big part of the character's turn as Green Goblin in the comics and his, like, traumatic relationship with his father. I think they handled those themes pretty well for a kid's cartoon. And I mean, it's what you say, Taylor. Like, they have you thinking, like, oh shit, it is Norman. Even Peter's like, oh, it's Norman. And then you see Harry, like, oh no, it's clearly Harry being a little, you know, addicted to the globulin green, which is just what a name that rolls off the tongue, you know? Like, everyone's trying to get some of that globulin green, you know? It couldn't possibly be related to the Green Goblin at all, you know? That's just a coincidence. But no, I really like this Green Goblin adaptation. I don't know if I'd say he's my favorite, if only because, God, Willem Dafoe, you know?
Oh, is Willem just puts in. Which cape. One? Which, you want to talk about Spider-Man 1 or No Way Home? Because any either one, you could be like, it's the best performance he's had. I really like this adaptation of the Green Goblin. I thought it was really good. I think we're going to get a lot more down the line with the character, which I'm pumped for. But overall, the one thing I think that came out of it that I enjoyed the most is it forced Tombstone and Spider-Man to work together. Because I adore the storylines to where the villain and the hero, they have to actually come to some terms and face a bigger threat. So it was really cool to see that happen here.
I would agree.
Yeah. It's like superhero villain team-ups are generally kind of the best you can get of both worlds. Because seeing them team up against anything, whether it's a bigger threat or just because both have the same goal at the time, makes it really interesting.
That said, I feel like that storyline is a little touchy when you're doing it. If you do that storyline wrong to where the hero and villain have to work together, I feel like it could potentially ruin the entire story. So, they did a really good job writing it the way the both characters are, the way they still interact with each other the entire time. I kind of also just like the relationship between Tombstone and Spider-Man. It kind of feels like Tombstone, while he wants Spider-Man to join him, it's a little bit like that, you know what, kid? Respect to you.
Yeah, it's like, you fucking suck, but, you know, game recognized game.
Before we get into the finale, and by the finale, I mean the entire Venom saga, because I don't think you can just count Nature versus Nurture as just a one-off episode. It's,
oh, hell no.
I can't wait to get into it. But let's talk about the other villains that we didn't really get a chance to talk about too much, because they were standalone characters. They didn't really have a huge arc in this season. And those villains were the Lizard. I've already talked about that character quite a bit. I'm not going to really... Or that episode quite a bit, so I don't want to touch on it again. Black Cat, Chameleon, Again, a pre-Mysterio Quentin Beck and a pre-Tinker, what is his name again?
Phineas Mason.
Phineas Mason. That was on the tip of my tongue.
Just so think what are your thoughts Phineas and Ferb.
On those? What are your thoughts on those characters?
They aight, you know? Like, yeah. I mean, I think Kurt Connors' Lizard is the best out of those side characters just because Connors is a character that you get to see, you know, repeatedly aside from just his one-off appearance as the Lizard. But, you know, even then, like, the Tinkerer and the Chameleon and Beck, they're serviceable. I mean, will we see them again? Who's to say? But just for this, you know, the initial episode of their debut, it was like, yeah, all right, these are Spider-Man bad guys, and we know what they're going to be.
And I have to agree. I do like the Lizard for the fact that literally it's the third episode where we get the Lizard, and also we get Peter's gripes with being Spider-Man fully on display. I guess I like more the Lizard just for what he represents to Peter in that episode. He's about to give up Spider-Man the powers that he was enjoying just two episodes ago, literally for the debut. And then it's like, but I saved him, and Billy gets to grow up with his dad, and I'm like, it's just so great. So it's kind of less the Lizard, more of Peter, but the Lizard represents something, and I'll stand by that he's the best out of the, what villains you just mentioned. I do like the Enforcers, though.
We don't get the Enforcers enough in Spider-Man things.
Yeah.
So it's nice that they're like,
the Enforcers enough in this podcast, because I forgot him again.
How you going to hate the Enforcers, King? How you going to do that? How you going to do my boys Montana and Ox and the third one? Fancy Dan, that's his
Fancy
name.
Fancy Dan. I was about to say.
Fancy Dan, though. I mean, what a name.
I know, and it fits. I mean, the dude literally it's is fancy. Doing acrobatics.
Dan's real fancy, I tell you that much right now.
So for me, I would say I really like Black Cat in this show. The initial fight that her and Spider-Man had was really cool between the symbiote suit that was escaping. And also, it led to one of the coolest scenes in the whole show to me, which is the reveal that he didn't know that the suit attached itself to him and took over. So he's just looking at it and he's realizing it, and just where you start to hear the symbiote version, which is just Josh Keaton doing an excellent job being that devil on his own shoulder there. So I thought that was great.
Yeah. I didn't recognize it upon first viewing when I was a kid, but as I grew up, I started noticing whenever the symbiote is speaking, his voice is just slightly lower each time. And it's only slight. You wouldn't notice it unless you're looking at it. But it's slightly slightly lower to show that it does have a malefic nature to it.
And we'll get to it when we get into the arc, but I love the way that they use things to show Peter's personality change, and including the way he dresses. So I can't wait to get there. But other than that, Lizard, of course, he's an iconic character for a reason. He's a very interesting character for a reason. He has a great storyline here. I love that episode he was introduced in. Chameleon, Mysterio, and Tinker, they were fine. I agree with you guys. It was one of those things that I think it was a good intro. Then I'm like, okay, I think the follow-up is going to be a lot better. You can tell that a lot of groundwork was being paid there, especially also with Black Cat. I found the relationship with her and Peter to be one of those to where Black Cat's really flirtatious and everything, and it really worked. And not only that, you can tell, like, they would have that friendship off the bat, and it didn't feel like it was completely forced. So I thought that was good. But let's talk about the Venom symbiote. So this storyline, I appreciated how this season just, it really had one overall story, and that was
Jacob Jingle Hammerschmidt.
I know. That Jameson name, man, it pisses me off, to be honest with you. Damn it, Stan Lee and Steve Ditko. Why? Why did you do this?
Stan Lee liked to have alliterative names so that way he can remember everyone.
There is too far with these names, okay? And I believe too far was with J. Jonah Jameson and then his son.
Okay, so,
we still don't know what the first J awesome. And J. I was going to say, we still don't know what the first J in J. Jonah Jameson stands for, right?
John Jonah Jameson.
Yeah.
Like remember his son is named John Jonah Jameson Jr. John Jonah Jameson.
I gotta Google this, because I could have sworn it was one of those things where it's like, oh, and even to this day.
Yeah, sometimes it is James, and sometimes it's John.
Okay, no, it is John. Yeah, he's John Jonah Jameson Jr.
So yeah, all the J's are just gonna continue on for a legacy. of Jameson's, and it kind of disappoints me, to be honest with you. John Jameson brings back a mysterious black goo that is the first signs of alien life in this universe, and this leads to, of course, the Venom storyline here. Let's talk about Eddie here, because I feel like you gotta start by talking about
Eddie.
How did you guys feel about this betrayal of the character, this adaptation?
Favorite Eddie Brock to this day outside of the comics. Because one of the things that you love about Peter's Rogues Gallery is the connection he has with a lot of them. I like the fact that this Eddie Brock is more of a childhood friend than just some guy that Peter pisses off. Feels more like Peter actually does stuff to get him to hate him with that unyielding hatred that we get. Because that is something that I will admit, like, Eddie just wants to blame all of his stuff on Pete in the comics. Where in this one, it's like, oh no, they were friends, and he feels betrayed.
Yeah, this one's slightly more justified in being the greatest hater in the Marvel Universe.
Yeah. So, to this day, still my favorite Eddie Brock adaptation. And honestly, considering Eddie Brock in the comics can go from a guy you can understand to being just the worst piece of shit you can ever imagine, sometimes he takes the place as my favorite Eddie Brock, period. So, I kind of like his spiral into sort of madness, especially with how he starts, like, becoming more reckless, how he talks to Mary Jane and everything. And, like, he's losing himself because of just, he's letting his anger control him. So, gotta love this Eddie Brock and kind of feel bad for him, but you also, like, still want Pete to beat him, so.
I agree with Drew. I think this is probably my favorite adaptation of Eddie Brock, period. To where the only thing I would say as a criticism, which isn't even criticism because I find it a hilarious quirk as a character.
The sideburns?
No, I was going to say the fact that, like, a few, I say dude a lot, I say man, I say bro, I use a lot of these terms. He says bro quite a few times in this show. To which sometimes when he said it, I would just bust out laughing and, like, man, come on.
He and Peter are like bros.
Come on. Yeah, it's like we were bros. And I'm like, I know you are bros. Y'all said it about 50 times. But it wasn't even a criticism, really. It's just something I found kind of funny about the character. But I love that they were both friends since childhood. That it's, again, this is the thing that I love that they did in this story, is they didn't show you everything in the first few episodes, which I think other shows have. They would try to do this early on and then pull the twist later. No, they very gradually and in the background give you the background story with Eddie and Peter. That Eddie helped Peter out until he graduated, kept the bullies off his back. They've been friends for a while. That Eddie somehow got a job with Kurt Connors. That both of their parents were friends. And that all this is just gradually being revealed throughout the show. So when the Venom stuff happens at the very end and we finally get the full picture, it's like, fuck, man, these are two really close friends who just hate each other now. And the thing that I really like about Venom, I don't know this is how the character's characterized in comics, but I just think of him a little bit like Reverse Flash to Barry Allen.
Mm.
Where he's just so petty. He's just so fucking petty. He will do anything to hurt Spider-Man. To where Eddie turned into Venom here, and I got those vibes from the character. And I was just like, yep, this is what I wanted.
You are
exactly.
Not wrong.
He's just...
Yeah, no, the man is an unqualified menace.
It's just, this is exactly what I wanted from Venom. I don't want even this sinister top-tier plan that can't be outdone. I just want pettiness. Webbing up stuff that you know Spider-Man's gonna go through and just being like, guess who?
Which, did you notice?
It's so good.
Did you notice? Peter wouldn't be able to read that, Eddie. It was backwards. Like, he came at it from the wrong direction.
Yeah.
We can read it. Peter can't.
But stuff like that is just, it's perfect. And we got the bringing the 90s show again. I think the 90s show did the pettiness pretty well. It's just that I don't think that they really wanted Eddie to be a relatable character. Whereas this show wanted to portray Eddie as a relatable character first. So you gave a damn whenever he decided to turn. Which, Drew, you had the problems with Eddie's turn a little bit, you said?
Yeah, like, so my whole problem is, like, when Eddie gets the memories and everything, and maybe the symbiote is keeping them from him, but it's like, my whole problem is, like, when Eddie gets the memories, he knows that Pete has been trying to protect everyone as Spider-Man, and he actually went out to help with Connors and everything. He realizes it. It's like, I've just a little bit of understanding or like acknowledgement of that would be just cool, but I guess it would interfere if Eddie realizes that Peter has been torn between these decisions and maybe his anger won't be as strong and he won't join the dark side where he and Venom can rule as symbiote and host.
So, Tristan, go ahead and take it away when I'm done. I'm just going to answer his question and you just take it from there. I think it was more so of, I get the feeling that he was told everything, that he was shown everything. It's just that Eddie, we saw to this point, kind of had, although he was pretty likable, you could see once he finally just gave up on Peter, that something just snapped in his brain, like a breakdown kind of thing. And there was nothing that could really pull him back. Like, he was legit terrorizing Mary Jane on their date.
Yeah.
I was just like, well, that's... like, they almost,
he almost killed them.
Yeah, he almost killed them and killed an old lady. And it's just, you can tell that something just snapped that, like, oh, this good person, he had that one bad day. And that one bad day turned him into this, not Joker character, but it just turned him into a villain. And it makes sense, but I think that's just, to me, that's what I took from it, is he was still showing everything, it's just they didn't give a fuck. He still thought it was Peter's fault and Spider-Man's fault.
Yeah.
But Tristan, what are your thoughts on Eddie Brock? And to answer Drew's question, I guess.
I'm in a somewhat similar boat as you, Taylor, although I will say, even if, like, I'm not necessarily certain that the symbiote showed him everything, but even if it did, I feel like it showed everything from a skewed point of view, because I mean, they say the symbiote feeds off negative energy, so I'm reasonably sure it just got its hooked into Eddie. It's like, oh, he hates Spider-Man too, let me just show him things edited in a way that will piss him off even more, to the point where even if he learns the truth, he won't care, because he's already so knee deep in this rage because of what I've shown him and what the fires that I've stoked within him, that he's just all on board the kill Peter Parker train.
Yeah, he's like the Palpatine to the Vader. Got it.
Yeah, that being said, this is still a pretty damn good adaptation of Eddie Brock, and it, like I said earlier, it owes a lot to the ultimate version of the character in terms of being childhood friends with Peter. Like, I think it's a great synthesis of the classic 616 and the ultimate version, even down to, it's clear that, like, Eddie Brock, like, in this, also maybe has, like, a crush on Gwen. And, you know, maybe that's kind of a scuzzy thing that happens with Eddie Brock in the Ultimates line, where he's a college student. He tries to get with a 15-year-old Gwen, and he's a creep. And that's when Gwen's like, hey, maybe this guy's a creep. Maybe Peter shouldn't be hanging out with him, you know?
Yeah.
But, yeah, no, I mean, I think, I don't know if I'd say he's my favorite villain of the show, just because I really do like Doc Ock and the Sinister Six. But I think he is probably, like, his evolution, even though it does seem like a pretty quick flip of the switch when it finally does happen, I do appreciate the way that they seed it through the entire, like, course of the season.
Yeah, definitely. I would say my one or two criticisms of this, I don't know what you guys think or how the comics are with it, and these are probably my only criticisms of the entire arc. Like, to me, this entire arc, I was just like, this is... y'all stepped it up from what was already a really good show to the last four episodes to me are nearly 10 out of 10s across the board. They're that fucking good. And it is that Peter was using the Wheat Line that are perfectly in symbiosis, and it never really felt like Eddie and Venom were, which I thought was kind of the reason why Eddie worked, is because he was the one who perfectly understood the hate that the symbiote had. So they both bonded over that hatred of Peter. So that we line with Spider-Man using it was a little off to me. Although it made sense, I guess, for the story.
You have to remember, the symbiote wasn't trying to be obvious to Peter. It was trying to seed into him slowly. So I can understand of not getting that perfect symbiosis. Whereas with Eddie, they are fully aware of each other this time around.
Yeah. So I guess that was really my only thing. And Yeah, I think that's it. Because I was going to say the classic bell scene was also in the daytime. I was like, yeah, that would have been cooler at night. But then we get the awesome Uncle Ben shit and everything. And then we go back and it's night and just it's so good. So what do you guys think of this entire arc here? There's a lot to go through, really, that we don't really have time for, unfortunately. But there's a lot of stuff from just diving into Peter's past, his psyche, and all that stuff.
Intervention is probably my favorite flashback of Spider-Man stuff ever. Having Peter have full interaction with both the symbiote and Uncle Ben being his devil and angel, and like Peter having to like go back and see the what happened to Uncle Ben, the stuff he feels are injustices that have been done to him, but also recognizing that he did those injustices himself and he has to take he's taking responsibility, but also the good that's come of it as well. It's like the perfect analogy for any superhero. It's like, recognize the injustices done to you, but don't let them turn you into the very things you've been trying to fight. It's just amazing. It's beautiful.
It's spectacular.
It's spectacular. Amazing. Sensational.
Web of.
Yeah, so, do gotta say, like, episode 12 is probably my favorite of the Venom arc.
There is a line in episode 13, Nature versus Nurture, that I thought was great. I love that Flash was the guy to bring Peter back.
Mm-hmm.
The show, that's the one thing I like about a lot of these Spider-Man characters, too, is although there's the bully character, there's the character who's a bit of a dick, there's a part of them that's a good person.
They're humans, somewhere. They're layered, they have different sides.
They come across as somewhat real people, which you don't see all the time. And Flash Thompson being the guy to bring Peter back, I thought was really good touch. And there was a line Peter had after Flash left, or Peter left, one of the two, where he said, well, at least Flash isn't possessed by an evil symbiote. Well, as far as I know. I thought that was a really good line. Because, of course, the whole Flash Thompson Venom thing in the comics. Yeah. So that was really cool. Other than that, too, I'm going to turn this over to you guys, or to Tristan. I don't think you shared your thoughts on it.
Oh, one sec, since you mentioned Flash, then Tristan can go. We'll say, I think that the show was came out like a few years before Flash came out as Agent Venom.
So that's just a coincidence.
Kind of a coincidence. I think it was like 3 years, but this show made me kind of feel like, yeah, it could happen. Flash could have that turnaround. Again, this show really helped me see like Spider-Man characters away from just the characterization that they initially started with.
So the last thing I want to mention before we get to Tristan's thoughts here is I love how they also changed Peter's clothes during this time. He's a lot more like, honestly, he looks more bulked up too. He just got a regular t-shirt on, doesn't have the long sleeve or anything. He's walking a lot more confidently. He's talking more angrily all the time. He's looking more angrily. I think that all added to the whole struggle with the symbiote suit. Well, I also think a lot of people love this story so much.
Yeah, it's due to his clothes. Peter wears baggy clothes to hide his muscles in the show, whereas when he has a symbiote, they're tighter because like he's more willing to show off his muscle.
Yeah, which makes sense. But Tristan, you got anything from this symbiote arc that you really want to talk about?
It was a fucking banger. I mean, that's like, it's probably I would say it's my favorite adaptation of the Spider-Man like symbiote saga that we've gotten outside of the comics. Like, even though it's only over the course of 3.5 episodes, really, like, it still feels very natural. Like, by the time you get to, oh, now Eddie's Venom, aside from the one, you know, flip of the switch, there we go, where Eddie's just like, all right, I'm gonna kill Peter. Like, Peter's whole progression, it feels very, very natural and very organic and just dope as hell. So that way, by the time you get to, well, Eddie's Venom now, you're like, you know what, okay, yeah, like, sure, let's just see Venom and Spider-Man fight. Like, this is gonna be dope. I love the way Josh Keaton portrays a venomized Peter. I think that the intervention episode where, you know, it is Uncle Ben and the symbiote, like, sitting there on his shoulder like the angel and devil is one of the best adaptations of an origin story without necessarily showing the origin at the beginning of any superhero thing we've got. You know what I mean? Yeah, overall, I just think it's a great way to end this first season.
And it feels right because the way Eddie was introduced, and like I said, the way that they decided to pepper in their story throughout the season, it felt like one very cohesive and interesting story to cap off this season. And I want to mention once again here, because I feel like both shows deserve some praise for how they handled the symbiote storyline, and that is Spectacular Spider-Man, what we're talking about here, and the 90s show. Because I think back to the coolest ways that I've seen the symbiote suit handled and that struggle. It is this and the 90s suit where they show like the symbiote swallowing Peter whole and all that. Like they're just perfection for different reasons. And I kind of have it written here in my notes here that I think the 90s series made Venom cool in like media, not necessarily the comics, because I'm pretty sure he was always pretty cool in the comics, but in terms of like in the media, he's that series was what made him cool.
I mean, I'm pretty sure that was his first like adaptation outside of the comics anyway. Yeah.
Yep.
And this show, I think it shows you how unsettling Venom can be. Not necessarily cool. Like, I wouldn't even go to... I know I have problems with design. I don't have a problem with the design of Venom in this show. I think it looks pretty cool. But there's just something unsettling about this version. To where he kind of comes across... You mentioned Eddie's been creepy in the comics before. He comes across very creepy in this episode. Like, he's full-on villain in this thing. And also, just how powerful he is compared to Peter. He's just a brute force of nature. But... how do you guys feel like it ended before we wrap up here? I kind of thought it was a little cheesy, but we talked about it before. Like, cheese works if the story's good. I thought it was good enough.
Well, and that's the thing. Like, I don't necessarily... I can't remember exactly, like, the air date when it came out, but, like, when the show was coming on, I don't really remember there being a break between, like, season one and season two. So... I can see how it would feel like cheesy or weird or whatever if it's like, oh, this is the season finale and now we're on a hiatus for the next 2 months. But I'm pretty sure it was just like, okay, now next episode, like, what's up? You know? It plays differently without the pause.
Yeah, that's typically how these episodes end, because as Drew talked about, like, you can watch this in order or you can watch this out of order and you'll get enjoyment out of it because the episodes are just fun overall. And because of that, you have to kind of wrap them up somehow, unless you're doing a long arc. And since it was the end of the arc, yeah, I can understand it ending the way it did. And like I talked about cheese, I think cheese works if you give a fuck about the characters or the story. You know, we just spent an hour and a half talking about how great this show is, so obviously we did. But, Drew, how did you think about the ending?
I gotta admit, after, like, that triumph, it does feel... The ending does feel a little weird, but I also feel like it does feel like Spider-Man. It's like Spider-Man never got those grandiose moments where he stood atop a building and everything was back to normal and it's back to work again. He's more of that guy who, like, just either celebrates with friends or just goes home because that's his life. So it's like, I get it. It does feel like, boom, go into the next episode, but at the same time, it feels like Spidey.
So that about does it for our Season 1 retrospective on Spectacular Spider-Man. Before we completely wrap up here, we have a few very small rapid-fire topics. Are there any other characters or topics that you really want to talk about that we didn't really get a chance to talk about here?
I have one thing. A, all the side characters are great. But can we take a second and talk about the unethical behavior of Aunt May's doctor if she's had a heart attack? Why is he at Thanksgiving dinner with them? That's... Like, is he trying to make something happen? Because, like, he made her blush. And it seems like he's trying to flirt. That's not ethical behavior from a healthcare professional.
Like, I'm not going to get into that at all, because who Aunt May wants to date is her own choice, and Aunt May's dating life is the stuff of nightmares and legends.
I mean, I'm just saying, the hospital board may feel differently.
True that.
The hospital board would definitely feel differently. Yeah. But, yeah.
I have to agree with Tristan. We didn't talk about the side characters enough. I wanted to talk about Mr. Rand himself. I like the fact that he starts out as just the bully who goes along with everything, and then slowly he's like, hey, be cool. It's like, he protects Peter from the water balloons and everything. It's like, he's really, really cool. I like him. Also, like that Phil LaMarr, I think that's him. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he voices him. Yeah, so.
We don't talk about Phil LaMarr a lot either. He wasn't in our voice cast. Phil LaMarr is a legendary voice actor, too. He didn't get a massive role, I think, in the show. But
the voice of Samurai Jack himself. It's like, he has a lot more work, but that is the work that I, like, remember 100% every time someone says Phil LaMarr.
He voiced Jon Stewart, too, didn't he?
He did.
Jon Stewart, Metron in Young Justice, as well as Aquaman.
And Aquaman, not just in Young Justice, but in the Injustice video game.
Oh. Oh, yeah.
And he voiced Gambit in Wolverine and the X-Men.
Yes, he did.
Not my favorite of his voices, I'll be honest.
But yeah, I agree with both of you guys. Side characters in the show are really good. I think it's a good thing, too, of like the growth of the characters is we look at the jocks, and it kind of feels like they're not friends with Peter by the end, but it does feel like they kind of grew from stuffing him in a locker to tolerating him, which I guess is the best Peter can hope for at this point in his life with those characters. So I do feel like there's growth there. We didn't talk about Gwen Stacy much in this either. I have always preferred Gwen Stacy as a character over Mary Jane Watson.
I'm
really glad they included her in the show.
With me, I like both. Both offer something great with the character. On one hand, you get Mary Jane Watson. She is the quintessential in a lot of people's heads. Now, I admit it, that mostly is from the Raimi movies and the 90s cartoon, because Gwen is not really focused on a lot in outside media. But this was the, it's like Spectacular Spider-Man was the series where I was glad that it was Gwen who was getting the love interest treatment over Mary Jane. So, and it's like, Gwen is a character who is like, her personality, whether you try to get from her classic personality or from her, the newer personality where they try to adapt her more for modern times, it all fits with me. And honestly, I feel like in adaptations, I like the banter between Gwen and Peter more than I do with Mary Jane.
I'm more of a Mary Jane guy myself.
I do think also they do a great job with all the characters really in this thing. Even including Mary Jane, who doesn't get a lot to do, but you can tell, like, she's there and she's gonna have something to do later on. It's not just, oh, it's a Spider-Man thing, we have to include Mary Jane. There's a reason for it. I like her interactions with all the characters. So, it's not necessarily even like, oh, I'm just glad they included Gwen into the friend group with Harry. I'm glad they included really everybody.
Yeah.
This thing is loaded with amazing characters, no pun intended, again.
Well, and they're all handled pretty damn well. It gets the dynamic right, because in the comics, like, the friend group was Peter, Harry, MJ, Gwen, and Flash Thompson. So, like, now bringing that to the high school level, like, obviously they had to de-age him a bit, but, I mean, you see the siege there. It was like, oh, yeah, Gwen and MJ are going to be besties, and, like, MJ's going to be like, yeah, Peter, get with Gwen, and then, you know, maybe one day Gwen dies, and they come together over their shared grief for the loss of their friend and loved one.
Let's go ahead and move on and talk about some pros and cons here. So, we're also going to give out our final rating at the end of our pros and cons. Drew, give us your final pros and cons for Spectacular Spider-Man, along with your final rating on a scale of 1 to 10.
So, for Season 1 of The Spectacular Spider-Man, I will start with con, because, again, there's only one, and that was Eddie getting the memories and seeing Peter being Spider-Man and everything. Only con. And honestly, you can sweep it under the rug. With my pros, everything. Like, no joke, it is spectacular. It is amazing. It is everything you need in a Spider-Man adaptation, 100%. So my final score, out of 10, 11. I don't know if I'm able to do that, but you know what? I'm doing it. 11 out of 10.
You are legally not allowed to do that?
Well, hopefully that's a felony, because Drew wouldn't be caught dead doing a misdemeanor.
No, I would not.
So a 10 out of 10 I'm going to go with for Drew here. Tristan, what about you?
My only real con is that it gets canceled, and that makes me sad. It just is so good, and I just want.
Okay, if we can put that so as a con, add that to mine.
Yeah, it's a con for me. Pros, I mean, it's what Drew said. Like, this is like just a fantastic Spider-Man adaptation. It's sensational. It's you know, amazing. It's spectacular. I wish someone would avenge it and, you know, bring it back. But I mean, I have to give it a 9 just because it being unfinished just irks me as a completionist. But it's through no real fault of the show. Like, it's objectively, I think this is probably the most faithful Spider-Man adaptation. And if you are a fan of Spider-Man, I think you would love this cartoon.
I echo all of your points. I agree with everything you guys said. I have some nitpicks on a few episodes. I've talked about it already. I'm not going to really get into them. Pros, just where to start. Every character here, I mentioned it a few times. I can't get over it. How many characters are introduced in this season? This one season. 13 episodes. And they're done very well. Pretty much across the board. And if they're not, like a Doc Ock, I didn't care for his first introduction as the official villain. He comes back in the Sinister Six episode and fucking crushes it. So they fix it. So, yeah, all the characters are great. Even though the animation isn't really my preference style, it's still quality-wise good. The voice acting is tremendous across the board. Josh Keaton, I cannot sing his praises enough as Peter Parker. He does such an amazing job. Cons, anything I really mentioned, just the nitpicks, I guess. For me, I'm going to give it a 9 out of 10 too. And you guys talked about, like, if you enjoy Spider-Man, you'll like this show. I will just go with it from my perspective, which was, as I've talked about a few times now, if you're listening to this for some reason, and you haven't seen the show, but you watch a 90s show, watch Spectacular Spider-Man. You love it. It's awesome. Alright, let's get out of here. If you enjoyed this episode and want to talk more about Spectacular Spider-Man Season 1, or any other comic book movie related or anything movie related, TV related, you can join our Discord and chat with both our podcast team and all the wonderful members of our small community. Also, be sure to check out the nerdstash.com for all sorts of news in the world of gaming, movies, television, and so much more. We have reviews, we have guides, we have lists, we have opinion pieces. So be sure to check out thenerdstash.com if you got the time. I want to thank Tristan and Drew for joining me. And I want to thank everyone else for listening in. We greatly appreciate it. We are going to be covering Spectacular Spider-Man Season 2 very soon. Very soon, because we love this show. But we're going to cover a movie retrospective in between our Season 1 and Season 2 episodes. And that movie retrospective is something Tristan and Drew have wanted us to review, again, loose terms there, for months, really. And that is a movie that may win Movie of the Year, and that is Everything, Everywhere, All at Once. Man, I can't wait to talk about it, though, because I've heard nothing but great things about Everything, Everywhere, All at Once. And I can't wait to see if it actually lives up to the hype that I have for it now. But that's a story for next week. So I guess we'll see you then.